Welcome, everyone. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. If you are, I think we're going to put this out as a regular episode for the whole audience, so not just members. But thanks to the members for supporting, and thanks to everyone else for listening. As is often the case with these bonus episodes, the entire crew is with me. That's Amanda, Dion, and Aaron. This is where I ask you to offer a greeting, or in this special circumstance, like a primal scream or whatever you're feeling.
I don't want to blow up my mic, so hey there.
Hello.
Fair. So yeah, we thought that we didn't know what else to do other than a post-election team analysis sort of episode. So that's what we're doing. We've read, or at least, I mean, I read, 90 hot takes or so on the election. So I sort of got the broad strokes. I think the official analysis kind of breaks down like this. Men are bad. White women are bad. We should blame Biden for being old and not realizing it. We should blame Harris for not breaking from Biden in a variety of ways. Inflation is bad. Like, people really don't like it, and they don't understand how it works, but they know that they don't like it. Gaza genocide, turns out, bad. Shouldn't support people who are committing genocide. That can be a problem for you. Sexism and racism totally had an impact. It would be ridiculous to suggest that that isn't in the mix, for sure. Gen X, I think, is going to get some attention in this election. The stats as they're coming out show they kind of like broke more for Trump than either of the generations surrounding them. And I think we'll talk more about that in a minute. Social media and TikTok and things like that, I think, are bad. I have thoughts on how to solve that. My 15-year-old nephew had probably one of the best political analysis that I have heard. And I just, I heard from my sister, his mother, that because he has a friend, like my nephews live in France, but he has a friend in New York, and his friend supported Trump. And he's like, "Mom, we're screwed. He's going to win because of TikTok." And I was like, "Yeah, I think you might be onto something. This is the revenge of the bros election." And then big picture, humans aren't built for big picture management and foresight. I started thinking of it in terms very similar to climate change. And I don't mean like, I was thinking of this election in relation to climate change and how it's one is going to impact the other. I started thinking of this election in the same way that I think about humans' failure to address climate change, is we're not good at that kind of stuff. Big amorphous threats, that is not what humans are designed to defend against. And it becomes so easy to put it out of your mind that you can end up walking straight into the jaws of something that you may very much like to avoid, but we're blind to it and don't see it coming. So that's the breakdown. Did I miss anything?
I might have covered it.
Solved it.
This is the shortest one ever. Thanks for coming out. It's been fun.
Yeah. Usually I pull quotes from articles and things like that. Here's the only quote I pulled. And again, everything I just read is part of it. And I want to highlight Gaza, because that was one of the starkest issues that Harris and the campaign like straight armed those activists, completely sidelined them very intentionally. And the analysis I've been reading has been talking about how that didn't single-handedly tank the campaign. And the reasoning for that is that, they break down like Muslim vote totals and how people broke out that way. And I thought, I don't think that Muslim people are the only ones who were really concerned over that issue. And that's a pretty bad analysis to pretend or be ignorant enough to think that it would break down along lines like that. But like, to give a sense of the strength of feelings people had about it, I pulled this quote, an organizer from, you know, a Muslim organizer trying to get Harris to bend on a ceasefire demand, said that they were worried that a vote for Harris would set a precedent that the Democratic Party can ignore its constituents who voice dissent over human rights violations. She decided to hold out until Election Day with hopes that Harris would make a last-minute change in policy. Such assurances never came. And then that person speaking says, I entered the voting booth and found myself unable to stop crying. All I could see was the face of a child in a city in northern Gaza, holding the body of their younger sibling who was killed over the weekend. I voted down the ballot, but left the top of the ticket blank. And it goes on to explain that some of her friends and family joined her, unable to get themselves to cast a ballot for Harris. Others who did vote for Harris cried or felt physically sick. And one friend said she had voted for Harris, but prayed for forgiveness afterward.
But let's blame them. Like, let's definitely blame them for not just sucking it up and voting for a flawed candidate. Like, the attention and the conversation that is going to be wasted on identifying these subgroups of people who didn't vote for her, instead of like looking at the reality of it. I know Dion wants to talk about, you know, the people who are completely okay with fascism, or at least not as worried about it as the economy. I do want to talk about those, but I do think it's important to talk about that there was a lack of effort, and the Democrats abandoned the left side of the party and instead made this pivot towards the middle that didn't pay out. They didn't have this group of invisible voters that year after year they flout and try to placate to, because of course there's Republicans who won't vote for Trump. Like, let's give them the better option. Let's give them a middle ground. What did you see? Did you see Republicans voting for Harris? Not in numbers that weren't comparative to Democrats voting for Trump. And like the fact that this was the strategy, this is the pivot, all the energy that came about in the lead up and when she came out, all the language that was so fucking strong and that I could get behind, all of that gone to, again, placate. Super mad, but like, let's talk about these subgroups of people and why they didn't vote, and let's blame them.
Yeah, I think The Onion had the best take on this a couple of days ago as the results were rolling in. They had an election alert, still too early to know which minority to scapegoat.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's, I mean, this place that we live in, this country that we live in, has always found a way to scapegoat some minority. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just the way this place functions. It's the way this place was built. It was far beyond scapegoating at its inception, but that's what this place is. And I think for me, like, this is just like I felt a little bit of hope after they decided that Biden was too old to run. And I felt a little bit of hope when Harris picked Waltz. It's like, oh, like, this is good. Like, he's a progressive. What they missed about what was good about Waltz wasn't his personality and his likability and all that bullshit that we talk about all the time. It's the fact that Minnesota does stuff for its citizens. Mm-hmm. That's what people are craving. Right now, we have two parties that are viable. That's it. There's no third party option. So this is what we have right now. And what we have right now is one party that is offering something awful and one party that is offering everything's good. We can just tinker around the margins. And I think we're all feeling it. I think everybody in this country is feeling pressed in some way by the economy or just life in general or just the news of the day. And I don't think either party is equipped to deal with any of it. I think the Republican Party's solution is more immediate and will make some people feel good, because punishing people makes some people feel good. And that's what they're offering. And the Democrats, on the other hand, were offering, what did Kamala say on The View about where she would differ from, can't think of anything, got nothing. So that's what was on offer. And the real story is that most people that pushed Biden over the top stayed home. Like, they didn't vote because they didn't feel like there was anything to vote for. And I get that. I do. I voted. I voted not asking for forgiveness for voting for Harris, but because I thought it was the better choice. But also voting for her thinking, we're going to be right back here in 2028. Don't have to worry about that anymore. Like, that's not the outcome. But that's what I felt. Like, I felt like this was a vote to kick this can a little further down the road.
Buy some time.
We got to stop kicking the can down the road. And I don't know how we solve this, but we have to remember that Joe Biden was not a good candidate in 2020. He was not going to win in 2020. He was not going to win the primaries in 2020. The Democratic Party machine got behind him, pushed out Bernie Sanders, and then who knows if Bernie Sanders would have won, would have not won. That's all speculation. But that's what happened, and there was a global pandemic. There was a lot of fear behind Joe Biden winning. And that fear, for some reason, people have just completely forgotten what happened 4 years ago, what happened 5 years ago, 6 years ago. The United States of amnesia strikes again. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the takeaway for me from this election.
Yeah, and I just think we should never stop mentioning that Joe Biden was elected under the premise that he basically promised to be a one-term president and could have set the stage beautifully years ago for a full, robust primary to happen. Maybe Harris would have won and maybe she wouldn't have, but it would have been a normal campaign with vigorous, interesting ideas from the Democratic Party. And that is what would have gone up against Trump ultimately. Given how Biden's campaign went and how Harris has ended, I think it's ridiculous to assume that taking a different tack would have been worse. So skipping all the way ahead to some of my conclusions for today is to repeat something that I said several months ago. I would love to see the Democratic Party as an institution that can make whatever fucking rules it wants, not beholden to any law of any kind. And I think that they should implement a new set of policies and like a cultural norm within the party to have primaries every 4 years, regardless of whether there's already a Democratic president in place or not, because we should just be so excited about democracy at every possible turn that it should never be seen as backstabbing for someone to enter a primary race against an incumbent. It should be part of the culture of the party that it is welcomed and normal and natural for anyone who wants to put their hat in the race to do exactly that. And that's how you end up with the healthiest candidates, the healthiest party, and most likely the best chance of winning, because we're constantly being tested. The way the party imagines things go now is that elections are bad because it makes people look bad. And that's absurd. Elections are what put politicians into the minds of people so they can understand whether they like them or not. And when people are sort of unknown entities, that's what's more harmful than becoming well known. Even if people like have some problems, like, oh, well, I didn't like what they said about this or that, or, I don't like this thing about their past, but at least I have a good idea of where they're coming from. obviously, you know, Trump was able to win and he has the worst past of anyone who's ever run, one of the worst past and best documented past. And it didn't turn people off enough, because it turns out it's actually about the policies people imagine will be put in place. A huge percentage of Trump voters say, I hate the guy, but I like his policies.
He doesn't even have any.
No, I know. So, I know. And then you dig deeper and you ask, like, well, what policies do you think he's going to put in place? And they're probably wrong about most of it.
And this is exactly it. This is what I wanted to say, is that this is about feelings. It's always been about feelings. Like, there may have been a time where people were more judicious and like a little more careful and did their research, read the party platform, like really dug into what policies are being proposed. I do not think we live in that world anymore, if it ever really existed. And there is no, like, the civic duty we talk about, like, it's not really a widespread thing. There are some people who are into that. For the most part, people are like, I'm too busy. And so it's all about what they feel. And that feeling, of course, comes from the media and, you know, now social media. And so if the feeling that is being pumped is things are bad, even if you aren't personally experiencing job loss or feeling like things are expensive, you're still going to repeat that. You're still going to be like, yeah, but I think they're bad. Like, even though I'm okay, I think things are bad. And this emotional knee jerk, and it gets inflated by that collectivism of social media being like, well, everyone says things are bad, so obviously things are bad. I mean, it's really not that much more complicated than that anymore. And so, you know, I think back to, like, was it 2 years ago when, you know, there was a video, they used like the, oh man, I'm so tired, I can't think of anyone's name. Maybe I shouldn't even try to. Christopher Walken. There was a Christopher Walken, his music video from years ago. They used it to kind of highlight all of Joe Biden's legislative achievements that year. And it kind of caught some fire. And there was Dark Brandon and all that. That's feelings. That is feelings. There's nothing about that. Like, yes, it came from some actual stuff that happened. But what was being put out is, don't you feel that progress is being made? Don't you feel good about what's happening? The feelings shifted. The other side won the feelings war. And people don't really care enough to understand what inflation is, how it happened, how Joe Biden and his administration have tried to work to make it better. None of that really matters, because it's about a fucking feeling.
And I think that's where I want to jump in on what I think is really wrong, is this, the feelings. Because, like, this is, you know, it's a, this was the most vibes-based election ever. And the vibes for Biden were terrible. Harris had a long way to make up. She didn't ever really break from Biden in a way that made it so that Trump could, he continued to, like, he was really flabbergasted at the beginning about how to run against Harris. And then he realized, oh, I'm just running against Biden. I'll just keep running against Biden. So he did. He just said Harris instead of Biden. And it worked. It was a one-to-one. So the vibes of that were in their favor. But what's amazing is he's not a new entity. Like, this is the same guy. Like, this is the same guy that we watched be terrible this whole time. But 70 million people watched that guy be terrible that whole time and thought, he makes me feel good. And what's the feeling that he makes them feel? And this is what white supremacy is. I heard, I think his name was Van Lathan, talking about that Trump is the final boss of white supremacy. He said, you know, he can't say enough things to be racist. He can't, you know, say enough sexist things to be sexist. He can't possibly be taken down because of white supremacy. This was the most white supremacy election yet, because this man is terrible, objectively, feelings wise, in every way. But 70 million people voted for him. And why? And we have to figure out why. If you're listening to this podcast, there's a good chance that you are a white person. and you have people in your life who probably voted for Trump. Ruin Thanksgiving. It's time to stop letting this shit slide. You have to confront the people in your life about this. And I know that there's large structures that we have to deal with that cause these things, but these, for a large part, are individual racist. Like, they didn't vote for structural racist reasons. They voted individually because they are racist. And unless we confront that, we will continue to be steamrolled by fascism, because that's what was always coming down the line. Because as long as the Democrats kept tracking right, we were going to end up here at some point anyway. So we can't, as individuals, sit back and say nothing. We can't hide. You have to confront it if it's in your life. If it's not in your life, you're living in a bubble, that's why you're shocked by this outcome. But if you do see it, you got to say something. And maybe if everybody starts saying something, we can start actually making some progress, because the people that are feeling this way are only listening to Joe Rogan tell them how right they are. They're only listening to any other Manosphere bro telling them how right they are. They need some other people in their life telling them that, no, you're wrong.
So I had this interaction. I'm noticeably queer. And I was with two other people who also you could definitely peg as queer. And we were walking into a restaurant, and there were three, I would put them at probably about 20 to 22 year olds, white coming out men. And as soon as they saw us, one turned to his buddy and was like, "Do you remember to cast your vote for Trump?" And like that interaction just like stuck with me. It's hard to believe it wasn't intentional, just because at the volume, like, we were still a good way away and like still several feet back. And yet it was loud enough, projected enough for us to hear. And it was just like timing wise, pretty perfect. So I was just a little mad, because I'm sitting here looking at these and I was like, bro, you can vote for Trump all day with, like, we're living under his tax policies currently. Any tariffs, things like that, those are going to negatively impact you. But of course, I'm thinking of it through logic and actual policy. And I was like, what is it about Trump that is so appealing to these? And I've read the analysis where it's like, well, you want to be able to say what you want to say and not be judged or have repercussions for it. But what like image instantly like popped into my mind when I was thinking about these young group and like what the Trump appeal, I thought about The Handmaid's Tale, appropriate, and about the scene where Alfred's taken into the club. And it's where all of these men get to indulge on things that have been banned for the general population. Like, they get to be in this exclusive club that they're allowed to behave in all the ways that they've cast others to not. Like, they're an exception. They're in the in-group. And that's exactly what Trump is about. They don't care what his fucking policies are. Like, it is the guy that at least young voters, I feel like, relate to. Like, yeah, I want to say what I want to say. Like, all these people telling me to do this, to behave that way. Like, you know, I want to be free, quote. And like, that's what Trump is. Like, that's the freedom in their mind they're going for. The freedom to act like an asshole and nobody hold you accountable for it.
Well, that's,
but it doesn't
click.
That is
what freedom means to them. No accountability. Yeah.
Yeah. And it doesn't click to them that they'll never be the in-group. Elon Musk does not care about you. There's like a joke going around about like Elon Musk and like someone, a girl talking shit about him, and like the boyfriend kind of like being taken aback, like, whoa, as if the choice was going to be like to choose Elon Musk, to have a relationship with Elon Musk over her. Like, he doesn't care about you. You're never going to meet him. You're not friends. Like, what is this want to be in a group with people who, like, you're never going to have access to? Never.
Well, I mean, we do live in a odd era of parasocial relationships. And if you say something bad enough on Twitter, Elon Musk might retweet you. And that's basically like having a friendship in this day and age. I was thinking about the Vibes election, and I agree, Dion, that Trump out white supremacied Reagan, but he definitely borrowed a lot from Reagan all the way down to the Make America Great Again slogan. Just in the last day or two, I was thinking about how Reagan was also a vibes candidate. And I realized in a way that I hadn't realized before and was sort of fascinated by how diametrically opposed the vibes were. And they both worked. Reagan's vibes were all about soaring rhetoric, city on a hill, mm-hmm. we're amazing. And Trump is the opposite. The everything's a disaster, we're terrible. And I get that it's two sides of the same coin pointing to, you know, if you elect me, we can either continue being great or become greater like we used to be or whatever. I mean, it's basically the same thing. But I mean, one of the first political conversations I ever had with a Reagan supporter, you know, I mean, this was an intergenerational conversation I had many years ago, and I was not equipped to have the conversation, so we didn't get very deep. But basically what the person was arguing was, but he made us feel good to be American. That was it. Like, warm, fuzzy feelings about being American. And that's why Reagan really won a sweeping victory. You know, like, Trump won decisively, and that feels like a big deal right now, but he was within a percentage point or two. Reagan really swept the board, and it was with that like soaring patriotic rhetoric. So it is interesting that Trump can kind of do the same thing, go straight for feelings and almost nothing else, but go dark and get a very similar result.
And I do want to point out, just for clarity, that we all understand that people are actually suffering, that this isn't like a delusion of feeling. Like, there's a sizable portion of the population that is suffering, that is not doing well, that is really struggling. And so it is both, right? There's the vibes for those who actually aren't getting touched by the structures that currently exist, and, you know, because they're built to work for those people. And then there's all the other people who are truly just trying to make it day to day. And that is not, you know, that is not a feeling, that is just a reality. And I haven't actually seen the numbers in terms of like economic breakdown yet. I don't know if anyone else has, but we as people on the left understand that that suffering has always existed, and that there has never been enough to address real poverty, real struggling, and that we have been totally morally fine with like children living in poverty. That's been fine. And only recently with the child tax credit did we do anything to kind of address that. And then, of course, the Republicans want to rip that away immediately. So it's this balance, right? Because like, the people who latch onto the vibes are people who will never want to see how similar they are, how much closer they are to people in poverty. They want to see themselves as closer to someone like Elon Musk. They are the temporarily embarrassed billionaires. They imagine themselves to be at the upper echelons of our society, when in reality, they're probably a paycheck away from ending up in poverty. And that is a delusion that has crippled us politically for a very long time. And now those same people are taking a gamble on, we're better than other people, so we deserve power more, and I don't care what happens to anyone else. There has been a feign of course we care about those who are less fortunate. That's been kind of like, because you're seen as a bad person if you don't say something like that, right? But now we're entering a phase in our politics where people don't care, and that's fine. No one's going to actually like push on you if you don't have any sympathy for somebody who's less fortunate than you. In fact, it's probably their fault. That's the narrative that's building from the right. And that's what won this week. What won this week was, if you're not doing well, it's probably your fault. But if I'm not doing well, it's definitely Joe Biden's fault.
I think in a couple episodes, we've specifically addressed the racism that's gone on. So I don't want to feel like my next point is discounting any of that. Because, of course, the open racism in which conservatives are now operating under is completely concerning. And part of the reason why Trump won is like giving permission to those parts of you that want somebody to blame. And, of course, stoking on racism that hasn't been dealt with. But what I specifically want to talk about is misogyny. I think it's hit in several points, and we've done a few episodes that have laid the groundwork for the understanding, but just so that we're all on the same page commentary-wise. Like, of course, yes, there was a woman running, but also this misogyny of tapping into anger. And like, this is a lack of intelligence and emotional intelligence, specifically in the male population, that is being given permission to act out, to blame others, tapping into that instead of like what's underlying all of it, which is fear. Like, it's taking that fear and kind of putting it to action in a very scary, violence-oriented way. But the misogyny, you see that in so many different realms, specifically with how they've targeted swing states. There was a bunch of money that specifically went into anti-trans ads. And it is, again, the fear of using protection of who they deem worthy, because their definition of women is a very particular, specific definition that not all people who identify as women fall under. So, like, those ads were targeted in swing states specifically because that was an issue they felt they could win on. If that is not stoking the misogyny that exists in our society, if we don't deal with this, yes, like, men are going to have more power, even though they don't represent, you know, the large majority of our population. Because of the misogyny, women are also not exempt from it. Like, we live under that patriarchal system. So a lot of women folded under this patriarchal thinking of daddy's going to take care of us. And who was daddy but Trump? So again, I just
Tucker Carlson made that literal comparison.
Yes, I know. Yeah. And it was so, so cringe. And as much as I want to dunk on all these little boys who think that's alpha and like he's the biggest beta I've ever seen, like I would love to spend time dunking on it. But like the seriousness of how men are doing and what they're reaching out to in answer for it, like if we don't address this, yes, fascism, yes, white supremacy, all of it. And like that's what's happening. It is actively happening right now. Mm-hmm.
Have any of you seen a Call of Duty, like a gameplay version of Call of Duty recently? Yeah. I saw a commercial for it in the middle of a game that I'm glad my daughter wasn't in the room for. It's so aggressively, realistically violent that, you know, I'm not a video games warp your mind kind of guy, but maybe that one. Like, it's such a ingrained, like that being used as any kind of entertainment is terrifying to me. But I do think it's indicative of the exact kind of anger and patriarchy and misogyny that Aaron's just talking about. To like broaden that out a little bit, I think what I'm struggling with and what I've struggled with for a long time, and I think we've talked about this, like Harris wouldn't have been my candidate of choice, but thinking back, like I don't know who would have been, because I don't think it really matters. Like, I think the difference between the parties is real. Like, they're not the same. I don't want to say that at all. But it's real for Americans. We are voting for our own comfort and how things work. And I think there's a small trickle-down effect on the rest of the world and the way that we treat them. But for the most part, this country thrives on the oppression of people across the globe. Like, that's wasn't going to change regardless of who we elected. Our economic system is based on exploitation. Our war machine, like we spend $1 trillion a year on war. We have trade embargoes on Cuba, and we have a giant military base in Cuba. A guy I work with was in the National Guard, and he didn't get his certifications to go do what he needed to do with his troop. Like, and they got shipped out. Like, where are they going? Guantanamo Bay. Like, ah, cool. That's awesome that you're going to go there. Saw a recent report that said 70% of Israel's war has been funded by the the U.S. And I call it war because that's what they called it in the report. But yeah, the genocide. We're 70% is our tax dollars. That's what we've funded the last year. That wasn't going to change dramatically either way. It probably will get worse under Trump, but until we start combining our domestic and foreign policy and stop separating them in our minds, like, you know, people on the left have said, you know, this is the imperial core. We live in the Death Star, and I would like the Death Star to function in a way that is good for my friends and family, but still knowing that the Death Star is going to go blow up some planets. And until we start talking about what we're doing to the world and what our taxpayer dollars are doing to the rest of the world, we're just kind of like,
yeah,
prioritizing our own comfort over everybody else's. And I don't feel comfortable with that. Like I feel a constant disconnect from what anybody in national politics is saying and what my politics are, because I'm sitting here in a very comfortable place. I personally am benefiting from this. I know that I am. Like, we talk about Palestine a lot, but we aren't talking about Sudan. We're not talking about Congo. Like, all these things that are directly because of our economic system and us being at the top of the food chain financially. Like, we're not addressing any of that. So this rot that is we're feeling in our country is just a byproduct of all the disgusting things this country does. I'm not saying don't vote for Democrats and go vote for Trump or stay home, because it does make a difference. It's going to make a difference in women's lives that Trump won. It's going to make a huge difference in anyone who cares about women's life going forward. It is a bad situation, but it's going to be a bad situation globally, regardless of what we do right now, unless we start talking about how out of control our foreign policy is.
Everything Dion just said is the exact reason why, despite me wanting Harris to win, is why I refuse to punch down towards people who withheld their vote for her, because that is what little power we have. I think Jay kind of touched on elections are accountability. Like, I am completely for every 4 years normalizing that in the democratic process. Since we make our own rules in primaries, we could do ranked choice voting. How could I punch down and get mad at someone for using what little bit of power we have? I can't be mad about that. I have to choose to rectify with the results and be okay with how people voted. I mean, especially that subset. Like, yes, I'm way more mad at people who actively voted for Trump. Like, I'm not going to let up on that side of us, like, being reduced to fascist ways. But as far as on the Democratic side, withhold your vote. Like, that's your little bit of power. And I understand you're not going to have much room with Trump. There's so many arguments you can make back and forth, but yeah, that's not the conversation I want to have after the election. Democrats do better.
But here's the thing. And like, I agree with everything you just said, so I don't want it to come out like I'm countering, really. But like, now that we are here, when we vote, let's just hope we will be able to in the midterms in 2 years. Now that vote means more than it ever did. Like, we've basically been condensing our power to the vote for a long time now because there are so few other levers to pull.
Yeah.
And so, yes, when you have this one thing that you can do, it definitely comes with a lot of navigating your morals, your beliefs, and how you're going to wield that one little bit of power. But now we're just in completely uncharted territory. And if we get the chance to vote for Congress in 2 years, like, that means more than it ever has. And that sucks and shouldn't be like that, because your vote should just be one of the many tools in your toolbox. But we've condensed it now in a way that we haven't experienced before. There has been a building movement of grievance that is completely impossible to fight back against, I feel like. So yeah, maybe Harris wasn't the right person. Maybe the Democrats should have had a whole, you know, really democratic system to pick a new candidate. Maybe Joe Biden should have stepped down a long time ago. I still don't know. Like, I think it would have been better, as we discussed. It would have increased our chances. But I do not know if it would have been enough to overwhelm the era of grievance and anger that we are living in. And having that kind of, you know, the bold new candidate, like the only thing that would have actually maybe given us more of a shot is like this bold new candidate who comes from the left, but who is totally disconnecting from the party, from like the history of the party and the direction that it's been going, and brings, you know, New Deal style list of exciting ideas to the table and policy change and says, I'm not like them. I am the new Democratic Party going forward. That's the kind of shift and like complete, you know, departure from what we've been doing that would have actually really been a challenge to the other side. But the modern Democratic Party was never going to let that happen. And so it's almost kind of whimsical to even think about, because like that wasn't really on the table.
For all the talk about motivations for voting and the era of grievance and Trump's hold that he has on people, what I think we like really cannot exclude from the conversation is that we live in an era of media consumption that happens through algorithmically driven platforms that profit more from disinformation and misinformation than truth. If years from now, historians and techno-anthropologists look back on this period of time and they conclude that somehow the simultaneous, almost exactly simultaneous rise of social media algorithms and people shifting from legitimate news sources to, oh yeah, I just get my news on Facebook or I get my news on Twitter, and the rise of Trumpism, and those historians and anthropologists conclude like, no, those actually weren't related, then holy shit, am I going to be interested to find out what their major explanation is? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, Dion, was it before we started recording, you were talking about the 70 million people who voted for fascism?
Yeah.
But they don't know. So many of them don't know, because, like, it's genuinely hard to know what people know because of our bubbles. Like, I had a conversation with one of you, I don't remember which, recently, where we're talking about how it's so much easier for me to project into the mind of a like rabid partisan Republican than it is to imagine what it would be like to be an uninformed person. Like, I just can't even get in a headspace of understanding, like, what's it like to go through life in this day and age not knowing anything or almost anything about what's going on, and for the like little bits and pieces that you're getting vibes of, you're hearing something or other, you know a friend was saying something about something, and every once in a while you catch a headline, but for so much of it to be bullshit or to be intentional disinformation or to have been unintentional misinformation that went viral because it was so shocking, and then you never hear the correction afterward. So many people who voted for Trump like don't even know the arguments against him. They don't know the fascism arguments. They don't know the historical comparisons. Like, they don't know. And so, I mean, there's probably 20% of the country that's like, things aren't going very well, and we probably do just need a king, you know? But that's only 20%. That does not explain his whole voter base. And I think a lot of his voter base can be explained by people don't know what he's said or done because they don't listen to the same stuff or read the same stuff that we do. I mean, I think I've mentioned it before that, you know, I've heard those interviews where Trump supporters are, they are read his quotes and they deny that he would have ever said anything like that. Well, that's not the Trump I know. He wouldn't say something like that. That's a terrible thing. But they don't hear the terrible things. And so, it, you know, getting back to like, yeah, it's vibes, it's feelings, and it's not just vibes and feelings, it's catered vibes and feelings that can be presented to you on an individual level so that you only hear the stuff that you like, that reinforces what you already believe. So if you're on the left, you're mostly going to hear how terrible Trump is. And if you're on the right, you're mostly going to hear how great he is and how terrible Democrats are.
This is all 100% true. Absolutely. However, I think it's letting them off the hook to not give them some agency and say that they are choosing their bubble. Like, we talked about this before the show, but I deleted TikTok because I was so off on this election. I thought Harris was going to win. I thought it was going to take a while. I didn't watch any of the election stuff. I watched none of it because I thought, well, we're not going to find out until 2-3 days. Like, it's going to be a while. I was completely off, and I realized, oh, it's because I was in a TikTok bubble. Like, for people like saying the same thing over and over again. And I get that. Like, Trump supporters are clearly in a bubble. Fox News has created offshoots of just, you know, hermetically sealed. The leader is wearing the most beautiful clothes while he's butt naked. But there is, in that same genre of telling Trump supporters what Trump has said and them having no idea, or telling them that Biden said it and it actually being Trump saying it. It's the same genre. They will say, give Bible quotes, and they have no idea what these Bible quotes are, and they're devout Christians. This is a long tradition of Americans specifically, American Christians specifically, of not knowing the book that they say that they base their whole life on. That not knowing that they base their whole life on this man that they're wearing flags and shirts. And, you know, that, again, that's not the majority of Trump supporters, but willful ignorance is still ignorance, and there is a choice involved in it. And I don't think we should let them off the hook for putting themselves in these bubbles as much as they do.
Yeah, I don't disagree, but I also have very strong feelings about understanding the separation between structural and individual forces. For years now, I've been pondering the idea of writing a book on this topic because I could dig in so deep. The big example from American history is that slavery as a system was bad, and everyone today, with a few Nazis as an exception, agrees that the system of slavery was bad. But there are millions of people who argue that the enslavers, usually because it's like, well, my great-grandfather owned enslaved people, and he wasn't a bad person. And so there's this disconnect. And the fight that keeps happening and has been happening ever since that war was basically like, are they bad people or not? Judging systemic forces and individual people needs a better discussion. We need a better discussion to understand that good people can get into bad systems, and it doesn't entirely excuse them from their individual actions, but it can sort of get us to a point where we can have more grace for people who act badly in a bad system than people who act badly when the system is not pushing them to do that. So the modern example, just with in this conversation about the election, is like, if there weren't algorithmically driven feeds that were designed with supercomputers and the smartest people in the country to be addictive and send out as much misinformation as possible to be maximally profitable, if that didn't exist and a person was willfully ignorant and sort of walled themselves off in their own little bubble, and they were a member of the John Birch Society 75 years ago or whatever, I would cast more blame on that individual person than I would cast on a modern day person who is stuck in their social media bubble. So yeah, like there's personal responsibility, but it's also degrees. And the way I feel about those people is different.
I think that the thing that I'm really into right now, which I never have been, this has been more Jay's thing. Like Jay has imaginary conversations with imaginary conservatives a lot in his head. And I don't, like, I just am not interested in doing that until like the last week for some reason. And then now, especially actually after the election, I don't want to do the thing where we like dissect like why and all these white people, why are they thinking that we did that already? And it didn't really give us any more insight, really. There's a lot of racism and all the stuff we thought was there. But what I actually want to do is talk to real people, because I know that the bubbles are causing us to dehumanize each other. I don't really want to have a conversation where I get to like, and that's how you feel. Wow. Like, that's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking to be like, hi, fellow human. I would love to know what's going on with you, because this is really destroying our whole world. Like, maybe we should have a conversation, and then maybe they'd be interested in the same on my end. And unfortunately, I just don't know that many people that I can have those kind of conversations with. But the bubbles are truly what is it. I mean, we talk all the time about how people don't bump into each other in real life. Like, there just aren't as many spaces to bump into each other and have to deal with each other and talk through things. Trains, as Deanne always says, would be great for that. We just don't have that right now. How do we create that? Because I have no interest in going and lecturing to somebody who voted for Trump. Like, I really don't. But I would like to talk to them. And part of this is because, well, okay, so very specifically, I'm very afraid that I will lose my health insurance. Full stop. I have a rare disease. I really need health insurance. As a currently self-employed person, the ACA is basically the only way that I can get it and afford it. I don't think that's going to be around very much longer. I know other people with my same rare disease who enthusiastically voted for Trump. And I would like to talk to them about what they think would happen to our community if our healthcare was pulled out from under us. And if RFK Jr. is leading the FDA and the health and the HHS and the CDC. I just want to talk to them about that. I don't have to convince them of anything. I genuinely think that we are at a point now where those conversations can happen. And like, maybe it ends up ruining Thanksgiving, as Dion instructed, or maybe it actually just like finally breaks down the walls, because they won. They're probably in a really good mental space.
Oh, yeah.
Let's just have the conversations. Let's just talk about it. Maybe it doesn't have to be as like volatile as we imagine it to be. Obviously, with some people, it will be. But it has to start somewhere. Like, it literally has to start somewhere. I recognize that there are horrific people in this world. And so those people aren't probably worth having like nice, nuanced conversations with. But there are a ton of people who just voted for him, who voted for Obama in 08 and in 2012. And voted for Joe Biden in 2020. So there's probably some conversations to be had.
There are, and I would never object to conversations like that. But to wrap up this point on social media and everything, like, there is no way forward without a structural addressing of how those systems work. And like, I've been doing more reading on Section 230 than I had, you know, any time recently anyway. And that's the law that says that social media platforms, I mean, any web-based platform, is not responsible for what gets published on their site by third-party users. And arguably that's the lifeblood of the modern internet and how it works. But when that law was written, social media was not a glint in anyone's eye. They had absolutely no idea that that was going to come along or how it would work. But what has happened is that there's a major difference between a passive website that's just like a forum where people publish and then it's just published, and an active publishing site that uses an algorithm to curate and promote. And so I think there's a strong argument to be made that Section 230 already shouldn't apply to active curation and promotion the way social media works, and that if they are going to use algorithms to actively promote things, they then need to take responsibility for what they're promoting. That argument already exists, but also the law could be reformed. I think without a fundamental change in our understanding of liability in relation to how those websites work, it's bailing out a sinking boat when you're already completely underwater, you know, like having individual conversations or trying to change individual minds. It's like, yeah, great. I mean, you may genuinely make an impact with a few people that you chat with, but systemically, the whole society is in this boat that is completely unseaworthy. And the whole idea of democracy being built on a foundation of a society that is a well-informed society. That's why journalism is protected as the fourth estate, because a democracy can't survive if people aren't informed. And we still have journalism, but we have a system that got put on top of it and like between consumers and journalists that is a misinformation machine. And so democracy is impossible in that scenario. And I think that's what we're watching play out.
So what you're saying is, again, absolutely true. We can't do anything about that right now. Like that ship has sailed. Like the only person in the Biden administration that could have done something about that, Lina Khan, like her job is on a clock. She's about out the door. I think for people right now, what we're looking for is things that we can do, and we cannot change the superstructure. We cannot change the system. You can change your, like the way you interact individually. You can have conversations with people around you. Like those are the things we can do. We cannot change the system of the social media bubble generating machine. We can't. It's not in the cards. You can, if you live in a blue state, write to your state houses and have them maybe try to do something on a state to state level, because like on a federal level, it's over. That's done. But if you California live in a blue state, you can do something. Yeah. California, if you live in California, it's
national.
Yeah.
Yeah.
California might be like the last best hope for something like that to happen. It doesn't seem like New York is headed in a very good direction. It seems like New York is headed in a bad direction, actually. But California might be the last best hope of that. So if you live in California and you're feeling a little beaten down, call your state house reps. You can probably talk to face-to-face your state representative. I can too. Mine's a Nazi. I'm not going to. But that's a thing you can do. Like, and if that's an option, you should do it. But for the people in your lives that you want to remain in contact with, and this is a thing that people that are close to me are dealing with, is that there's been a drift over the last couple years because of, I think, honestly, specifically Joe Rogan. Like, I blame him specifically for a lot of this. But if you can still leverage relationships you've had to maybe bring somebody back to some semblance of sanity, you should do that. And in the meantime, like, yeah, call your local representative. That's a real thing.
Yeah, actually, this is probably a good time to say that Indivisible is launching their new playbook. It's coming out next week. And so people should pay attention to that, because they do that kind of work. Like, they tell you how to do the nitty gritty on the ground in your community work. So we'll definitely put out that resource when it's available.
And I do want to acknowledge that everybody's tired right now. Like, talking about people doing things when they probably felt like we have been doing things might not be the tone. To me, like, Amanda, I completely hear what you're saying about wanting to talk to people. But I think the note I would add to it would be to gauge, like, if this is one of those 20% or
Sure. That's what I said.
You're so far gone.
There are a lot of people that are. And like that work is done for people who don't have the weight of oppression on their shoulders the way that others do. And I think that maybe that just needs to be said. Like, that's not so for those who are in the direct line of fire right now.
Yeah. And I know that all four of us know each other, and we know that that is a unsaid thing in all of our points. But I did want to make it a said thing, because I do know that there's marginalized groups that, like, they don't have a lot more to give at this time. Like, they are worried about families, personal safety. Like, Amanda, thank you for being vulnerable and sharing about the healthcare, because that's a very real thing that you have every right to be concerned about. I think I struggle with, clearly there is an educational gap in even curriculum that teaches people this, and I don't want to overstate it, but like, it's emotional intelligence. Like, we're losing empathy, and like, people are prioritizing their own needs over community needs. And that used to be something that I do feel like was taught and was part of our curriculum. And it's not anymore. It's very individual based. You need to perform a certain way in order to succeed. You're like losing the benefit of, you know, those around you, like the community sense of that. I don't feel like we have that anymore. So like, I'm struggling because, you know, someone close to me who's a very big Trump supporter, like, would completely say that they loved and cared about like me, about Allison, about us being together. They would deny, you know, the threat of what this presidency actually looks like, despite the facts, despite, you know, their response to Roe v. Wade being overturned, like, prior was that'll never happen. And then it happens. Mm-hmm. And now the goalpost gets moved. Now it's like, okay, but now it's at the states, and the states aren't going to do that. And then the states do it. And it's like,
there
okay.
won't be a national ban, et cetera.
Yeah. Like, it just keeps moving. And like, the empathy that person could possibly have towards us, and the love that they possibly could have, like, there is a disconnect. They're not understanding how their vote is directly impacting our lives. And if something happened and Alice and I, for whatever reason, were not recognized as a married couple anymore, like, I know they would think that was awful. I know they would be extremely upset, but that's not keeping them from voting the way they do. And so, like, definitely emphasize the fact that, like, there is a portion of the population that's completely lost. And it's not worth the conversation, as awful as that sounds.
No, there are people who, I hope that was really clear. And when I said that there are people we not spend time on.
It was.
If we have any hope of coming out of this, people have to see the consequences of their actions in their real lives, in the people they love. And they will, sadly. They will, because a lot of terrible things are going to happen.
And you don't owe anyone connection. Like,
no.
I do think that there's a shaming, like, you know, in democracies, it used to be popular to own your vote. And now we've made it very personal. We've made it secretive. Like, no, own it. If you're going to vote against me having rights, like, show it.
Aaron, your story of the people who have this like obvious disconnect going on remind me. I promised at the very beginning of the show we would get back to the effects of the Gen X election, and so I just want to do that before we're wrapping up. And you know, I mean, we know a few members of Gen X, hashtag not all Gen X, you know, Dion, don't take offense here, but we'd sort of noticed a bit of a pattern of like the Gen X vibe is very often, it'll be fine. And we saw it come up again and again. And upon further reflection, it feels like a defense mechanism, right? It's you know, these are not like sociopaths or nihilists, but their actions almost present as like, it'll be fine. And so
let's not get hung up on the details is often how it comes out.
Yeah. So the disconnect between, I don't want any of those horrible policies to go through, but they probably won't. It'll probably be fine. So I'm going to go ahead and vote for those people. It just comes through pretty strongly. And the election results are sort of bearing that out, that Gen X is like bulging with Trump supporters, whereas they are surrounded by generations on either side who voted for Trump in lower numbers, both boomers and millennials. And I don't know, as an elder millennial, a geriatric millennial, as we're sometimes called, which is ridiculous. You know, we came of age with the discussion about us being like the next big impactful generation. We're a big generation. We're politically engaged. We're very progressive. And as always, Gen X just got skipped over. Like there was no discussion about the political impacts of Gen X. It was like the boomers are in power, but don't worry, the millennials are coming. And no one even bothered to talk about Gen X because no one ever bothers to talk about Gen X. And now Gen X is like aging into power and influence, and their general sense of the world is, it'll be fine. And when fascism's on the ballot, that does not bode well for anyone.
This is so rough to deal with because I just like, in large part, I do think that there are disconnects with that generation. And I think there's strategic messaging that happened on the conservative side. While there was very strong anti-trans language, you'll notice that it was more selective and anti-LGBT. That's because Gen X have gay kids. They're gay. Like, that is not a winning issue necessarily, even if long-term policy goals are implemented to do away with same-sex marriage. That is not going to be advertised. That's not going to be at the forefront. I do think you would lose people. There are definitely people who your safety is not going to be prioritized. They are going to choose grocery prices to vote on over human rights. And that's hard to deal with. But I feel like this Gen X, it'll be fine, is like in not taking what people say they're going to do serious. Like it is almost like, well, last time, like, was it really that bad? And like, when you review the data of what happened last time, it was like, yeah, but you're like, I was okay. And like, Allison's dad is of that generation, and his text messages as a gay man to her were like, I mean, it's fine. We've lived through this. Like, I didn't notice anything happening to me. She's like, the only thing I can imagine them doing is taking away gay marriage, and I'm not married. You're saying that to your gay daughter.
God.
Who is like, what? And all of his messages were the same. It'll be fine. Like, it's not going to be as bad as what you're imagining it to be.
Yep. They're banking on that.
And like, that is infuriating to me. He didn't vote because like, it just like doesn't affect me. He is that voter that Jay was talking about that is completely uninformed, that when you talk about him, you're like, how can you possibly not know that Trump made these openly racist remarks at his last rally? How do you not know that? Bubbles. He's on all of the TikTok. He's on Instagram, Facebook. It's his algorithm. His algorithm is nursing videos and funny animals and nothing about politics.
Actually, Deanna, I know you want to jump in. That's a good point that I want to talk. When we talk about filter bubbles, it doesn't always necessarily mean that you're just seeing right-wing or left-wing stuff. Like, you can be neutralized. Like, all Taylor Swift stuff or all brat summer shit. Like, it can just be, like, nothing that has to do with what actually matters.
So, as the resident Gen Xer, I have to not defend.
But, I was like, don't defend yourself.
not defend at all. I saw the symbol of that kind of disconnect in play when the person I voted for president first, William Jefferson Clinton, against Bob Dole, was brought out on stage to basically say the most horrific shit I've ever heard in trying to get people to vote for them in Michigan to Muslim voters, like scolding. But the disconnect being like Reagan gets a lot of shit. Reagan gets talked about all the time. We have established Reagan as a bad president and responsible for a lot of the things that we're dealing with. William Jefferson Clinton, he needs a lot more like connection to what he did to get us here. He normalized a lot of stuff that Reagan did. He
get ties to the party. Oh yeah.
He normalized corporations shipping their jobs off that decimated the manufacturing industry that I was coming up in as that was a viable job when I was coming out of high school. It's not now. That all went away in my lifetime. So this defense mechanism that Gen X has, we've just been going through one tragedy after another, one dramatic downturn after another, and hey, we're still here, I guess, is the idea. Mm-hmm. But to just be so passive about it, to not engage, to even actively make it worse is unforgivable, I guess. It's not the right word because, you know, again, who knows where you're at and why you're there, but it's difficult to understand. It really is. I still can't get over that Donald Trump was 4 years ago. How can we forget what happened 4 years ago? It wasn't that long ago.
Because COVID wiped our freaking brains. I mean, that's the other piece. Maybe that's the one that wasn't included on the list. Yeah. Is COVID fucked everyone up. Royally. Mental health issues off the charts. Major disruption to people's lives. The world changed overnight.
This could very well be a response to that. I just want to go back to before COVID. Right. Let's just go back to before COVID. And Trump is a connection to before COVID.
Technically, strange way.
Yeah.
I don't even know if it's a before COVID, though. If you think about it, I mean, I'm not saying
don't think about it.
I'm not saying that there weren't people who economically suffered, but the end of the Trump presidency into the beginning of Biden's, there were a lot more tax credits. There were a lot more financial incentives to help people out. There were pauses on student loans, all of those things happened. They also got lifted then under Biden. So we felt the great effects of it and then the drop. And that is what people are pissed off about. Had Biden done anything to ensure a little more money in people's pockets, I bet it wouldn't be as and I'm not saying Trump wouldn't have won, because again, hindsight's 2020. We could do all of the speculation. It's not going to change what happened. But I do think that the feel of being at a strong point and then not be, that's real. It was a real thing people experienced.
They could have run on ending child poverty. That was a real potential.
Yeah, we talked about that.
It was right there. And now we're, hopefully there's another COVID so we can get some tax credits, right?
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, they could have ran on a better abortion. I'm so sorry. I cannot get too much into my Democratic feelings because they literally had the weakest stance on abortion. That doesn't make me feel good.
Can you elaborate on that, Erin? I don't know what you're referencing.
Essentially, Harris was looking to have Roe v. Wade be re-implemented but not fix any of the gaps and things as far as when they believe that late term abortion and things like that were going to be legalized. Her and Trump didn't have differing views.
Sure.
So she didn't stand out enough. She wasn't offering a better before. Roe v. Wade again was very flawed. How funding worked, the availability of clinics, all of those things needed to be looked at, and you could have had a really strong abortion that looks at not just bringing and legalizing and going back, but offering something different and better. And they didn't.
It is worthwhile to have these conversations about what should have been done better. At the same time, it only helps if it actually helps us going forward. And like, do we see that happening? Do we see a Democratic Party that is willing to be an actual resistance front and not hashtag resistance like it was last time? That is the difference. Are you going to actually stand up to this psycho or are you going to mealy mouth it like we did last time? That's the difference. And like, I don't know. I don't know what we got here. Did we shock the system enough? Everyone always talked about, oh, Trump wins, we'll shock the system and everything will be great because we'll reinvigorate people. It didn't really do it that much last time. There was some energy, but not to the party structure that we have to work with. That didn't happen.
And
back
I mean,
and forth on feeling absolute rage and mourning.
This is where I think this conversation is important. Like, this is talking about 2026 primaries. It is so important that people participate in the primaries, that people run, that there are options, and that people vote. Like, we have to have better primaries. We have to have better candidates when we get to election day. So, like, I do think that it's constructive to talk about messaging because I'm here in Georgia. Like, I was in a swing state. I got heavily targeted, and it was with immigration bullshit. Like, I'm sorry, but you being a cop, I don't fucking care. Like, that's a reason not to vote for you. That's not, and I mean, I'm very informed. I was never not going to vote for her. But if I was an undecided voter, like, that's not it. That's not the message in Georgia that has fought to not have Cop City built. Like, that's not us. So,
it's not
like, I think it's not Atlanta, but like, the votes that you're going to get in Georgia are the cities.
Yeah.
And the climate in the cities is way different than the rural areas that you're never going to win. And I'm sorry, but immigration, like, we have an ICE prison in Georgia. Like, we see the effects of the border policy. Running on a strict border policy does nothing for this voter base. So if anything is to come from this in 2026, have actual platforms and run with strength.
So fear not. We have plenty of time ahead of us to consider and take action on what activism paths are the most effective to take. I just wanted to go through the hot off the presses list that came out of the reading I've been doing since the election. And sort of on personal terms, honestly, there's a lot of talk about getting yourself personally ready to be able to take action when activism opportunities are available, when organizations are ready for volunteers, all of that sort of thing. The first one on there is to strengthen community ties. And just as a personal story, like, that one hit me before I read it. Like, I had an instinct. I think I want to go on a road trip and visit people I haven't seen in a few years, you know? And like, that's kind of what it was. It was like, I just want to do some friendship maintenance. That's what this moment in time feels like it's calling for, you know? So that was on the list. Strengthen community ties, do some friendship maintenance, engage in community, whatever that means for you. Pace yourself. I can talk about this from personal experience in a weird way. I both felt the urge in 2016 to rev up engagement, rev up action, but also heard from listeners who were doing the same thing. And people like wanted to listen to more, read more, do more, and burnt themselves out. And so, because I make this show and then could watch throughout the Trump years as listenership numbers went down, at the moment when you would imagine, like, hey, you know, the country's in a really bad way, people should be listening to more, not less, progressive media, our listenership numbers were going down. And I would hear from people pretty regularly saying, I just can't. Like, I support you. I love what you're doing. I just can't handle it right now. I need to tap out, basically. And so my advice, knowing that that is coming again, is pace yourself, understand what your limits are, and do what it takes to increase your limits, like self-care and all kinds of things that make you more able to engage, but also do not overdo it. This is not a sprint. this is a marathon for we don't know how long. So, you know, if you like, rather than I just can't, I need to tap out, like if you need to listen to less politics, engage a little bit less, maybe do more of the community building, friendship maintenance, those sorts of things, that's fine. Personally, I recommend like just pare down your media consumption to only Best of the Left, but that's just me. Next thing on the list is find your path. And I had thoughts about this. We haven't been doing activism segments as much recently for lots of complicated reasons, but I'd always had the sort of sneaking suspicion, like us doing activism segments and constantly telling people you can take action doing this right now might be sort of perversely demoralizing. It's almost like having a list of things you're not doing being read to you. So it's like, oh, that's another thing I can feel guilty about for not taking action on. And so I have some thoughts on how to sort of reframe that to be a source of inspiration rather than frustration or depression. And then I think the last thing here is from this Truth Out article, 10 ways we can prepare for another Trump presidency. They bring up the Serenity Prayer, which goes with everything I was just saying. The Serenity Prayer being, of course, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And the article points out, notably, that prayer comes from theologian Reinhold Niebuhr as he was watching the rise of Nazis in Germany.
I did not know that.
Me either.
I just started reading a book called The Illusion of Control. Unrelated.
But relevant.
Pretty relevant, yeah.
Yeah.
You can only do so much. People are people. Like, everybody's got their limits. Everybody has life stuff. You are not responsible for fixing the country.
Yeah. Like,
that's not any one person's responsibility.
Yeah. There's actually been a lot of good stuff circulating about that, and I was pleased to see it because I think everyone's in the same headspace right now. One of the things in those articles was about having a regular group of good people you love and care about come over and have like a hangout and maybe talk about politics or maybe not. There's even a sample agenda in there for that kind of thing. And boy, is that going to be important.
Get to know people and engage regularly. You know, I mean, like friendship and community isn't necessarily built on having a well-crafted agenda. Like, that might be helpful too, but, you know, friendship and community is built on just being around people, spending time together, shooting the shit, talking about whatever. And if you have that base, then having the conversations about politics, activism, all of that can come much more easily. And those relationships are sturdier, like a stronger foundation. So all of these things are self-reinforcing. You know, it's an all of the above, that you can engage politically and find community there, and you can find community that either becomes political or doesn't, but it gives you personal strength and resilience because you have a community you can depend on and a community that can depend on you. But that's that. I mean, obviously, these articles get into lots more detail about the benefits of these sorts of things. But there's a lot of, like, when fascism arises, it attempts to deconstruct society. And so one of the best ways to fight against that is to build your own communities and hold fast to them so that you can't be broken apart. Whew. Did we solve it? We usually solve it for non-members who don't know at the end of the bonus episodes for members. We usually have solved the problems we've discussed by the end.
In progress. Work in progress.
Okay. Solutions in progress. I'll take it. All right. If you have any thoughts you want to share on this, keep the community conversation going. And send a voicemail or send a text to 202-999-3991 or send an email to j@bestoftheleft.com. Thanks for listening. Go home, actively engage, build power.